Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Good evening. How are you?
I'm okay. It's been a nutso week.
Yeah, it certainly has.
I mean, sunroof was open again this week.
Briefly.
Briefly. Yeah. Then it got cold-ish. But it really isn't winter still.
No.
It's baffling.
Could be a late-onset winter.
I don't want to hear
that. I don't want it either, but it's
possible.
We're halfway through.
It's very scary. It's very scary.
The rodent did not see his shadow, I guess.
He did, too.
Oh, he did. Okay.
He absolutely did. And why they pull that poor unsuspecting dude out of his little burrow. I wish the thing would just bite these people. It's so obnoxious.
I bet in Punxsutawney, it's probably like the big tourist.
I actually had friends go from Canton to Punxsutawney
I would never do that.
Me neither. I'm like, really? Why? To watch this poor unsuspecting groundhog yanked out of this whatever.
There's no velodrome or anything, is there?
Not that I know.
Well, then
of.
Why would you go?
Right, exactly. There's no bike race.
What else is new?
Well, I'd like to take a moment to apologize for the glitch we had this week. If you try to get a download and weren't able to, we were off a little bit. And thank you, RJ, for straightening it out and when it was brought to our attention. So if you ran into a problem and you haven't downloaded last week's show and you want to, you can now.
Hey, in IT terms, it was a win because he fixed two things and only broke one. So, and I can say that because I'm an IT guy.
Yeah, I know
so,
you are.
Yeah, that's the way we count. That's the way we keep
I
score.
See. That's the one step forward and two steps back?
Exactly.
Well, we had that kind of a week in bicycling as it was. So Congressman John Mica, Republican of Florida, did in fact introduce the American Energy and Infrastructure Jobs Act, and in which all the bicycle and pedestrian programs were summarily eliminated. Then there was an amendment brought to the committee, and it failed, 29-27. So it was very close.
Wow.
Yeah, very close. However, because I sent my little please don't kill funding to Congressman LaTourette, who's in my district, and got a very nice letter. In fact, he will be on the show next week to talk about it because he introduced the Safe Routes to School program, as you remember, last year or this last spring, whenever it was, into the transportation bill. So he, I think, is going to, they call it, offer the amendment to restore funding to bicycling and pedestrian stuff back on the floor next week.
Good.
Or whenever it comes up. So that's cool.
Now, what I read, it wasn't just the funding. There was, like, all kinds of supportive language taken out of this bill where it's more than just zeroing out the dollars. It's really a fundamental shift in the tone and attitude of this legislation that really just says, you folks that don't
drive a car right.
or a truck,
right.
They're talking about
keeping them off federal roads and all kinds of keeping bicycling. And yes, there are some really severe changes in this particular bill. I don't know that it's going to get anywhere, but it got marked up and pretty much decided on really quick. So we'll see where it goes from here.
Yes, we will. We'll keep watch.
We're also going to learn more about bicycle and pedestrian sustainability and other issues when we speak this evening with Benjamin Freed a little later. Benjamin is the editor-in-chief of streetsblog.com.
Okay.
Now, StreetsBlog is a daily news source connecting people to information about sustainable transportation and livable communities. It's been online since 2006. It's covered the movement to transform our cities by reducing dependence on private automobiles and improving conditions for pedestrians, cyclists, and transit riders. And StreetsBlog has offices all over, or I should say websites all over the country. Benjamin is the editor-in-chief in New York City, and all the other editors report to him. So it'll be interesting to talk to him. And then remember last week I said something like the universe sometimes opens up and good things pour out?
Mm-hmm.
Well, our first guest is one of the goodest. I know that's not a word, but it is for me. He's the goodest. One of my colleagues, Frank Havnunian, who is the owner of Drexel Hill Cyclery in PA, we converse by email. You know, sometimes he needs a part that I have. Sometimes I need shoes he has, whatever. Anyway, a few weeks ago, he nonchalantly said, would you like to have an interview with my friend Frankie Andrew? And I'm like, I'm speechless.
Wow.
How about yes? So after some correspondence and finagling of dates and times, I'm honored that we will be talking with Frankie Andrew this evening.
Wow. Very cool.
Frankie is the veteran of 9 Tours de France, a multiple Olympian, a world champion, a national champion, and the only American to finish in 2 of the 9 tours in which he raced. His career took him all over the world. He raced on what is arguably one of the most well-known teams in the world, the U.S. Postal Service team. Today, he's a coach and a motivational speaker, and I am pleased to be able to speak with him tonight. So, Frankie Andrew, welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining us this evening. I'm honored to have you on the show.
Thank you very much.
I have to start with something our buddy Frank Havnunian said to ask you. He wants to know what it is about cycling that keeps people so addicted to it.
It's fun. I think that's a big part of it. You know, a lot of people, that's how I got into racing, is that I wasn't very good when I first started racing. I just loved it. It was a lot of fun. It was a good group of people, and I enjoyed it. And I think when people are riding, they get the enjoyment out of it. They're getting fit. There's a lot of healthy benefits to it. And, again, there's still, cyclists are a great group of people to hang around with, and I think that that attracts a lot of people to it. You know, a lot of people don't have to follow bike racing. They just enjoy riding the bike.
Right. Well, and you've been riding and racing bikes since you were 10 years old. Were there others in your family who were racing, or did you just get on a bike and said, okay, I want to go fast?
No, my dad used to ride, but he never raced, and so I started riding with him, and then the club that he belonged to was going to start a racing team, and so I decided to try it out, and I liked it. It was a lot of fun. I also have 2 younger sisters, Celeste and Lisa, and when they were racing, they were each 5- and 6-time national champion in the track, the road, whatever. When they were like midget, intermediate, they cleaned up everything. They were fantastic powerhouses. They eventually phased out of the sport, and then by the time when they started phasing out is when actually I started doing better. And then I just, you know, I continued with it.
So did you start on the road or on track?
No, well, when you're really young, I was doing road and track.
Okay.
And then I was definitely focusing on track. And when I got first picked up by 7-Eleven, that was on for the track. There was a Sundance race series, so I was doing pursuits and points races, all this track series stuff. But the training, you know, 90% of the or 80% of the training is on the road to get ready for the track stuff, the endurance track stuff. So it kind of carried over both ways.
So the track that you rode on was in Michigan?
Yeah, there used to be a track here called Doré Velodrome.
Where was it?
8 Mile and Mound Road in, well, I mean, I don't want to say downtown Detroit, but a bad area of Detroit.
Yeah.
And used to have a huge following. We'd go out there and bring out our brooms and sweep the track, get all the glass off. There'd be burnt out cars in the infield. I mean, it was a mess, but we made, and I think the banking was like 5 degrees. I swear it was like dead flat, but it made do. And what made it work was the coaches of Claire Young and Mike Walden, who were famous cycling names from this area.
Absolutely. So Mike Walden had a camp down in Florida for a long time. I'll bet you attended one or two, huh?
Yeah, he used to have the camps down there that had a huge following, and
sure,
a lot of people had a lot of fun. You know, I mean, if you can get out of Michigan and get to some sunshine, anything will work.
Well, there is that. So do you think track racing, since you were a track champion, do you think track racing is going to ever sort of reemerge in the United States? It's such a cool sport.
It's a great sport. And anybody who's starting to ride or get into cycling, I would recommend definitely getting on a track, because there's a lot of elements to cycling, from pedaling technique to bike handling, learning how to read a race tactics. All of that takes place extremely fast on the track, which would benefit any Criterium or road racer. But I think Criterium and road racing is more popular, and I don't know if track racing will ever get, you know, picked back up to the way it was, you know, way back when in the 50s or 40s or whenever it was. It's just, it seems to be even more fringe than what road cycling is.
Yeah, we actually are getting ready to open an outdoor one here in Cleveland with the hopes of putting it under roof eventually. And I'd love to see it happen. We did have a track here during the 40s, during that big six-day era back in the 40s.
Right. So we have a track up here in Rochester, Michigan. Probably 6 or 7 years now it's been. It's a wood 200-meter outdoor. They have regular season races. They even put on a six-day. They put on a three-day. They do in conjunction with some other tracks. They have like a little series going on. So, there's some great racing available on the track. And as you just said, there seems to be velodromes popping up all over the place where there never used to be any.
Well, I think it's a really, really cool thing. So I want to move a little bit into your racing career. I mean, you've been to 9 Tours de France. You're an Olympian, a national and world championship, all the stuff you've done over the years. What do you think and makes a great and consistent rider like you are? I mean, you had 12 years of good competition in racing.
I think there's two things. One, obviously, you have to love the sport. I mean, because the amount of hours, the amount of miles that you put on the bike, that's a lot of time involved in training and racing and traveling. And so you have to be able to enjoy it, to be able to stay fresh in your mind so that you can continue to go through the process, to push yourself, to be able to do well in the events. And I think that is a big part of it. And I think another part of me being able to ride as long as I did is that I knew my role. Sure, I had, aspirations. Sure, I wanted to be the captain, but I knew I was never going to win the Tour de France. I knew that what I was good at was helping some of the stronger guys to be able to win races and working on the front and, being that domestique that was able to help guys. And I think by realizing that allowed me to be able to keep a job and be able to continue in the professional peloton for, the 12 years that I did.
Well, that's an interesting point, that it really is a job. And some people see this glorious, riding through the Alps and making all these attacks and, racing down hills. But it really is a job, and you have to train for it and live it like it's a job.
No, 100%. I mean, there's a lot of time and effort, and it is a job. And it sometimes, as much as some people don't feel like going to work in the morning, the same thing happens when you have to go out on your bike, even when it's a sunny day, or if it's living here in Michigan, it's 10 degrees, and I got to go out and ride. There's a lot of work involved. There's a lot of travel. There's a ton of sacrifices because you can't eat things that you want. You can't go out and party with your friends. You sort of live a very secluded, in a bubble type life, all circled around bike racing. And when I was doing it for a long time, I really didn't realize all the pressure that I felt for training and getting ready for the season until I retired. Once I retired, I couldn't believe how relieved I felt and what like a weight seemed to like lift off my shoulders.
Interesting. Very interesting. So, I mean, you have a family, you have children, you have a wife. It would be hard. You were gone how many months a year?
Well, I lived in Nice, and at that time I had my wife and I had my oldest son now, which was the firstborn. So, yeah, it was stressful, and I have to give a lot of credit because I don't know how they do it. Like Jens Voigt, he has like 6 kids. George Hincapie with 3. Christian Vandeveld. All these guys who are spending months and months on the road, not just with one kid, but 2 kids and 3 kids, and the kids are getting older, that's tough. That's tough mentally for the athlete, for the rider, but also for the kids to keep having the parent keep going away. But again, it's, like you just said, it's a job. It's something they have to do. And you can only be a professional cyclist for so long. And these guys are getting up there in the years. They have to take advantage of being able to do it as long as they can, make as much money as they can. Because after that, once you enter into the real world, it's a free-for-all. It's every man for himself.
Sure. I mean, well, you have people like Eric Heiden who said, that's it, I'm done. I'm going to go to school. I'm going to be a doctor, and I'm going to, have a life. Right.
Yeah, and it's pretty impressive to be at the top level in sport and then go to the top level in your medical profession. And then, of course, he's a doctor helping out with Team BMC along with Max Testa.
Right, exactly. We talked to him last year sometime. Really, really a nice guy. Really a
Very nice guy.
Not to say you're not a nice guy here. So let me take a second and remind our listeners, we're speaking with Frankie Andrew. He's up in Dearborn, Michigan, hanging out with his son at the hockey rink, getting ready for, I guess, some sort of a playoff, huh?
Yeah, we're coming into our playoffs, exactly. So
very cool.
We'll have to see what happens.
Let's talk a little bit about bicycles themselves. So in the day when you first started racing, let's say past junior in the regular racing, you know, Cat 1 Pro stuff, what were you riding in those days?
Well, when I first joined 7-Eleven, we had one of these, I think it was an Eddie Merckx bike, but it had a Huffy sticker on it, and still had down tube shifters, and might have just came out, would have been the clipless pedals and stuff like that, so very different, and for a few years, I used to race with a bar end shifter, which I loved, because I was able to keep my hand, it was like, I was ahead of my time. I wanted to keep my hands in the handlebars and be able to shift. So I was way ahead of the STI stuff. And that bar and shifter worked amazing.
So you're talking for the rear derailleur. You didn't really care about the front so much.
Yeah, you just leave it in the big ring.
Of course. What am I thinking?
No other option.
Of course. What am I thinking? It's always big ring. That's funny. As I remember, though, Mike Walden used to say, first 500 miles of the year, you're always in the small ring.
No, that's true. He used to be a big proponent of spinning, which I followed up on, too. Spinning, heels down. And, in the beginning of using that small gear to get a lot of pedal revolutions, to get that muscle memory going, and then, you know, kind of get everything kind of locked and loaded before you start using the big power gear stuff.
Yep, I remember that. By the time you got to retirement, what were you riding then? Were you riding carbon fiber?
Yeah, I was riding carbon fiber. And last year in 2000... we were on the Trek, I don't know if they were the Madones, but they were the Trek Carbon Fibers bikes. And night and day difference. I mean,
used
to have like a 25-pound bike to having, you know, an 18-pound bike, incredibly light, the shifting, the tubulars, the wheels. No matter what you did, you felt like a rocket ship. It was fantastic. It was great.
So that really sort of leveled the playing field in terms of equipment. What about size? I don't know exactly how tall you are. I mean, I've seen pictures of you, but are you tall? Are you short?
No, I'm tall. I mean, Sean Yates, who was one of my mentors who I kind of followed and looked up to, he was a tall rider, like 6'2", 6'3".
Right.
And I'm the
okay.
same, 6'2".
Got it.
You know, George Hincappie is a tall one. He's a bit skinnier than I was. But there were other big guys in the Peloton, you know, including like Cipollini or Aros Pulley, Magnus Backstedt. There were some big guys. And then, you know, of course, we all looked for the flatland classics type races where you go the opposite direction to these little skinny guys that, you know, live for the mountains. And
sure.
I dreaded the mountains in the Tour.
Yeah, I dread just looking at them. So let's talk a little bit about diet, because it seems to be a huge sort of question mark these days. I mean, we've got people really racing and riding vegans, vegetarians. Diet's a big deal. And as I remember years ago in the Coney book, it was like, there was no sex, there was no this, there was no that, there's no beer, there's no nothing. What about diet? What did you eat and what do you recommend? I know you're doing some coaching now and you're doing some speaking. So what are you recommending for diet for people?
No, I mean, the main thing with dieting is just to have control over the portions. And you not to get too crazy. And as you said, you know, there's vegetarians and there's vegans. And for some people, that works really well because they may have an allergy to wheat or dairy. But when you go on those types of diets, for sure the weight is going to come off. And as a professional, you know, any pro who's racing in the Tour de France, I mean, if it's not their number one objective, it's their number two objective, is to shed weight. And the object is to shed weight but keep the power. So you have to be able to train in order to get that weight off, and you can't just strictly do it by diet. And there's a balance there. I mean, once you get down too skinny, you start risking getting injuries and getting sick. But when I raced, I just, I ate healthy proteins, pasta, just tried to control the portions and kind of do a carbohydrate recovery drink after a ride so that, you know, I wouldn't kind of keep eating pasta all day long.
Right. How many hours a day did you train?
Well, it would vary, but I mean, you know, easily 4 to 5 hours a day. Have long days of 6 to 7, and you know, a short easy day honestly would be, you know, over 3 hours.
So you didn't train 7 days a week, though, did you? Or did you?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe not in the wintertime, but once the season rolled around, train 7 days a week. But, I mean, once the season rolls around, normally what you're doing is you're resting in between the races. The racing is so hard and so intense, all you're doing is trying to recover. So you go out for 2 hours, 3 hours. You might have a long day of 5 or 6 and then rest again before your next race. So there actually wasn't a whole lot of training in between all of the races that we're doing. And that's something that's changed a lot with the new cycling calendar and the new kind of operation of the way the riders tackle the season, is they'll skip a bunch of races so that they can actually train and build themselves up to a higher level. Instead of like racing all the time, resting, racing all the time, resting, they can actually get to a higher level by, you know, staying away for some racing, training, and then peaking at when they need to.
So if you could go back and look at all these races and all these events and all these things you've done over the years, what was your favorite race? And one that maybe you've done more than once or even once. What was your favorite event?
Paris-Roubaix, by far, there's nothing like it in the world, and that's what sets it apart from everything else. I mean, you go over there and you're racing 80 races. You're doing most of them on cement roads, up and down, on the freeways, whatever. Give or take, they're almost the same. There is nothing like Paris-Roubaix. The bricks, the dirt, the rain, the fighting for position, going onto the cobbles. It's complete chaos. It's crazy, and it's fascinating. And even now, just, you know, watching the race is so exciting because you never know what's going to happen. The favorite doesn't always win. The strongest doesn't always win. It's a toss-up, and it's exhilarating.
What about the Olympics? Now, I don't remember. Did you race track in the Olympics, or did you race both track and road?
My first one was track in 88 in Seoul, and I was ace. And then my second one was the one in Atlanta in 96, and that was on the road. And in 88, I was in way over my head. I mean, I was young, and there was guys that were much, much better than me. And it was a dream come true to make the Olympics. Going to Atlanta, definitely more pressure in the U.S., representing the country.
Sure.
Wanted to do well, and so took that. I don't want to say I took it more seriously, but it was a lot more pressure to be able to do well. And you know, for me, I didn't get a medal, but it turned out great. I was very happy to end up with fourth.
Well, and this is an Olympic year, so are you planning to go over to Europe this year and do your little shtick with the TDF?
I probably will be going over with Bicycling Magazine again.
Cool.
To do with the Tour de France. Yep. Did that last year and had a great time. Did Tour Talk with James Start, and we had a lot of fun doing that. So same thing I kind of did with the Versus crew, with the interviews and the stand-ups and all that, except now it's just on the web.
Which is kind of interesting because so many more people will really participate in that. So maybe what you should do is sort of like, you know, do your tweet things, that Twitter stuff or something.
You know I don't do that.
Well, you know, you could learn. Yeah, you know, old dogs, we can learn, us old dogs.
Well, I know, but I'm sort of against it. I don't want to do it.
Oh.
I don't need to know what everybody's doing all the time.
Well, me neither. It does get a little, like, too personal. You're absolutely right. I agree. So, I'm going to ask this one question I ask everybody who comes on the show who's had anything to do with racing, and that is, do you think the sport is being cleaned up, and is the biological passport working?
Yeah, I do. I think the sport is much better than what it was 5 years ago, and even way beyond in how clean it is compared to 10 and 15 years ago. The whole mentality of the managers, the directors, the race organizers, everybody wants a clean sport to try to make it fair. And I think it's definitely headed in that direction. And, you know, when there's money on the line, you're still going to find guys that try to push that limit or try to cheat. And I think the biological passport program has done a pretty good job in catching most of those. And hopefully they continue to be able to weed them out.
Well, you know, and then, of course, you have the UCI making ridiculous rules. They're the part of the problem, in my opinion. But, of course, the cheating is really what I was interested in. And I hope that the sport continues to stay clean. It's, you know, it's such a beautiful sport to watch. You know, if anybody's ever watched a bike race, it's just amazing to watch at any level. Even your community level bike races are so much fun. They're so much fun. So are any of your kids going to start riding, or have they started riding? Are they interested?
They whenever there's a local race, as you said, you know, and I tell people all the time, if you've never been to a bike race, you just got to go out there and watch it. You'll be amazed at how fast these guys go flying around the corner, bumping elbows, crashing. It's exciting. And so my kids come out, and they love it. And whenever there's a local race, there's always a kids race. So I'll have them do the kids race. And then my oldest son will race, like, the intermediate age group. So he'll have a USA Cycling license and be able to, you know, run around for about 20 minutes. And he does okay. He doesn't train. He I can't get him to, like, hey, you're going to get ready to go do this race. Do you want to go ride and get ready for it? He's like, nah. So I'm like, I'm not going to push it. I'm like, all right, whatever. Just go out and ride.
How old is he?
12.
Yeah, well, what are you going to do? He's a preteen. You can't tell him anything. He knows everything.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? This has been so much fun. I really enjoy talking to you. I hope we can someday meet up and have a face-to-face. And I hope you keep riding.
I've been riding a lot and trying to stay fit, and I enjoyed the interview very much. So I appreciate you working with my schedule. And glad this was all. And you know what? I'm going to have to come down and ride the Cleveland Velodrome.
You know what? Your invitation is wide open. We're going to have the guy, I think his name's Brett Davis, who's the head of the foundation, trying to put it together. And they are pushing for the last bit of funding to get it to open. And they think it's going to open this summer. So I'll tell you what, I'll make sure you're on the list and get you down here.
All right. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Frankie. Have a great evening.
All right. Thank you. All right.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Frankie Andreu joined us from his home near Dearborn, Michigan, where he was getting ready for his son's hockey game. And he was nice enough to take time out and talk with us this evening. What a great guy and a great interview.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. I've been so looking forward to it.
Yeah, another guy who's retained his passion for cycling, you know, over these many years, even after he stopped racing.
Yeah.
Yes, that's great to see. And
yeah,
still
and
rides.
Long career. 12 years is a long span and staying up there. I mean, if you look at his resume, oh, my goodness, he raced in a bazillion races.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
All right. After that, we need a little break.
Okay.
And when we come back, we'll bring you some news. And then another interview with the editor-in-chief of Streets Blog,
Ben Fried.
All right. Right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
It's that time of year again. WJCU's Radiothon 2012 kicks off on the weekend of February 12th and runs through February 19th with special concerts, studio guests, and premiums as we ask you, our listeners, to step up and pledge your support for quality local radio served up fresh every day with no commercial ingredients. So get ready for Radiothon 2012 at WJCU.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
And we are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. Time to jump into a little news this evening.
There's actually a lot of news this evening,
okay.
But we'll see how much time we really have.
Okay.
So we're going to go from the absurd to the sublime. Mm-hmm. From BikeRumor.com on February 1st, it starts out, found 63-gram carbon fiber cassette.
Whoa.
From experimental prototype. Posted by Tyler, who's the editor of Bike Rumor, tucked away in Injong, Sweden, as a little company called Experimental Prototype that's making the kinds of things that we love to geek out about.
Hmm.
Things like a 63-gram custom ratio 1123 road bike cassette with 8 of 10 cogs made from carbon fiber. For just €300, or around $395, and about 6 to 8 weeks of breathless anticipation, you can get one of your very own in any gear range and combo you want. Need more? They specialize in making pretty much anything you want by hand, usually from carbon fiber or titanium, from the looks of things. Things like replacement lefty steerer tubes, tie chain rings, cassette cogs, and so much more. So you can take a quick spin through their website for a gallery of lust-worthy hacks and one-off upgrades. And by quick spin, we mean 20 minutes of your life, poof, gone. And so they say, want to drool? Here's the website. It's HELLORE.SE/experimental-prototype.
How is a carbon fiber cassette durable enough?
Nobody said it was going to be durable. It's light.
I have no clue. So we're in the Cleveland area, and we live through the King LeBron James era, right? Man, this came through the airwaves so fast, even though we know that LeBron James rides a bike. Well, evidently, with all the hoopla over the Florida primary, there was so much traffic, LeBron couldn't do anything but ride his bike to the arena for the game, the Heat versus the Bulls on Sunday.
Huh.
So this per Jason Gay from the Wall Street Journal. Of course, this ends up in the Wall Street Journal, which is hilarious. So a photo taken by a local named Peter Lee surfaced on Twitter. James atop an oversized mountain bike, which was built for him. It's custom. Backpack strapped to his shoulders, tattoos peeking out from a black Lycra jersey. But everybody's making a big deal that LeBron was riding his bike to work. Here was his comment. You guys drove here? You guys are crazy, he said after the game to the reporters.
I hear that his employer provides a shower at his office.
Oh, you mean like a locker room full of them? I would imagine so. But it was funny because somebody else was taking a shot at the stadium or at the arena, wherever they play. I don't know where they play in Miami. And they had a bike in the background. They showed where the bike was kind of like parked.
Probably got a bike parking facility inside too, I imagine.
Yeah, it's called a wall. anyway, we'll move on. All right. So you know Brian and I rode Rag Bride back in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's sort of the party on wheels for you and 20,000 of your best friends.
Yeah.
Well, we would sit around at the rest stops wondering how much money the food vendors might make over the week that they're – because food vendors are sort of chosen for this ride. And they're parked at different places. And every day you see the same ones. So there's Tender Tom's Turkey and there's Mr. Pork Chop and there's Veggie Mama and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this week we learned just what a ride like Rag Bride might bring in revenues to a state that hosts such an event. Bicycling is big business. Just ask Iowa. Large rides like Rag Bride support local economies by bringing thousands of riders to small communities. The Register's annual Great Bicycle Ride Across Iowa generates, ready, $364.8 million in direct and indirect benefits to the state of Iowa every year, according to a new study, Economic and Health Benefits of Bicycling in Iowa. This study shows there is a reason to be encouraging more bicycling every day, says Mark Wyatt, executive director of the Iowa Bicycle Coalition. Rag Bride is a huge event and known across the world. Communities in Iowa understand the economic potential of the event. The study was conducted by the Iowa Bicycle Coalition, by the University of Northern Iowa Sustainable Tourism and Environmental Program. It was sponsored by a grant from Bikes Belong, Creating Great Places, and members of the Iowa Bicycle Coalition. So I thought that that was a pretty rousing reason to put on a big state ride. Now, I don't know what GOBA does here, which is our Great Ohio Bicycle Adventure, but I'm sure, you know, they go to, what, five or six different little towns in every single summer with 3,500 people.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if you've heard of this. Roads Were Not Built for Cars. It's a bike. Well, it's a book by Carlton Reed, and this is not the first bicycle book
I've heard that concept, but not of the book.
No, it is an e-book, but he's sort of letting chapters go each week.
Uh-huh.
And the piece that I saw this week is about bike paths from the 1890s. It's really interesting. So Mr. Reed is going to be on the show in about a month. And if you want to see, yeah, it's really a pretty book, too. He's done a lot of work on it, and he has a lot of other cool bicycle books, and they're all e-books. Which is very cool. They're not real expensive. If you want to see how he came up with his title and see some of the awesome stuff he's doing, it's roadswerenotbuiltforcars.com, just like it sounds.
Hmm.
Okay.
So back then, was it Trails to Rails?
I don't know. I had another story. It was a Zen story. And it was by a guy named Ed Brennan. And it's been told before. He was just retelling it. But it's very long. And I'm going to leave it out for what I think. Remember I said absurd to sublime?
Okay.
My favorite story of the week. Bartali Arnard for Saving Jews During the Holocaust by Cycling News, published January 28th. The UCI releases details of how Italian smuggled photos and documents in his bike. Tributes have been paid to cycling great Gino Bartali, with evidence now showing that he helped save the lives of up to 800 Jews during World War II. The Yad Vashem Memorial in Israel is looking into giving him the title Righteous Among the Nations, which is a very high honor, a term used by Israel to describe non-Jews who risked their lives during the Holocaust to save Jews from extermination by the Nazis. The details about the Italians' actions in the 1940s have only just recently come to light through a university study. His son, Andrea Bartali, has continued the research along with the Jewish community and journalist Laura Guerra. In 1943, Bartali, who had already won the Tour de France once and the Giro d'Italia twice, was assigned to the traffic police by the fascist regime before leaving the job on 8th September, according to the UCI. That was when he went underground, choosing to help persecuted Jews by smuggling identity photos to a convent that produced counterfeit papers. In fact, valuable documents were hidden inside the frame and saddle of his bicycle. Bartali remained modest about his actions, not even telling his wife. His own public comment was, quote, "Good is something you do, not something you talk about. Some medals are pinned to your soul, not to your jacket." Mm. He was imprisoned for 45 days in late 1943, officially because of his support for the Vatican, which opposed the fascist regime. However, he was never tried and was ultimately released.
Hmm.
Isn't that a nice story?
Yeah, very nice.
Yeah, I like that story.
All right.
So that's my news for this week.
Excellent, excellent. Glad to hear.
So now I think we should bring
our next guest on to our final guest for this evening.
All right. Well, our final guest is Ben Fried. He is the editor-in-chief of Streets Blogs, and he is in New York City. Good evening, Ben. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this evening.
Thank you, Diane.
So you wear the big hat at Streets Blog. You're the editor-in-chief. Can you tell us a little bit about Streets Blog, what it is, what it does, and then how you got involved with it?
So Streets Blog is a daily news site that covers transit and biking and walking issues. And we're really coming at it from the perspective that the status quo on our streets does not function as well as it should, that our buses should be moving more efficiently, that the streets should be safer for cycling and safer for walking. So our whole perspective is that we can change our streets so that the city works better for the people who live here.
And how long have you been with Streets Blog?
I joined Streets Blog in the beginning of 2008 as a reporter.
And how long has Streets Blog been up on? It is basically just web-based, right?
Yes. The impetus for Streets Blog was to have a kind of online nerve center for originally just the New York City movement, what we call the livable streets movement.
Well,
and to answer your question about when it started, it was back in late 2005 that the founding editor Aaron Napperstack got Streets Blog started originally.
Wow! So he was one of the early blog dudes.
Yeah, there really was nothing like Streets Blog at the time. I think you know, bike-centric blogs. It was really just Bike Portland and Streets Blog back in 2005.
Well, you are in the city with probably one of the most bicycle-friendly traffic commissioners on the planet, and she seems to be getting a lot done. But Streets Blog itself is available not just in New York City, but in other areas. So how does it work that, say, I don't think there is one in Cleveland, but I know there are other places.
Yeah, we actually, one of our employees does live in Cleveland, Angie Schmidt, She runs a fantastic blog called Rustwire. just to take a step back a little bit and get back to the origins of the New York City blog, because,
yes,
you know, our presence in other cities kind of use the New York City experience as a template. You know, when Aaron founded Streets Blog in 2005, we didn't have such a progressive transportation commissioner. And there was just a general sense that New York was falling behind leading world cities when it came to stuff like implementing the most, the safest bike lanes, the type of infrastructure that really gets people of all ages out on the street feeling comfortable cycling. We weren't keeping up with cities like London when it came to pedestrian safety, and we were falling behind cities like Bogota when it came to bus programs.
Really?
Yeah. So what StreetsBlog really set out to do in the beginning was to really focus people's attention on the fact that the people calling the shots in New York could be doing a lot better, to bring us up to speed with what the world leaders were doing.
So beside all the disaster in Congress, what were the most interesting stories this week, do you think?
I do think the disaster in Congress, I mean, no matter where you are in America, that is, it's kind of the overriding story. So it was just hard to escape that.
True.
This week. One piece of good news was that the United States Department of Transportation is going ahead with its fourth round of Tiger grants, which are, ways for cities and towns to apply for federal funding for projects that might be pretty hard to fund through their normal channels.
That's interesting that they're going ahead with Tiger grants and they're stripping safe routes to school. We'll move on.
Well, I think the good news with what's going on in the House is that they've kind of shown their hands that they're not serious about passing a bill. So all this terrible stuff that they've dreamt up, in the end, I don't think is going anywhere.
It probably won't, actually. You're right. And I think a lot of it was fear-mongering and just sort of pushing buttons. But it did push a lot of buttons this week. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Ben Fried, who's in New York City, and he is the editor-in-chief of StreetsBlog. A very unique and interesting way of finding out what's going on about cycling, pedestrian, and transportation issues in cities. And it is mainly cities. Yes, Ben?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think the issues that we're talking about definitely affect rural communities and small towns, too.
Okay.
But the primary readership for StreetsBlog are in urban areas.
Okay. And so what kinds of things do you actually recommend accomplishing certain things, or are you just reporting?
We take positions.
You do?
Yeah. And, for a long time in New York, before Jeanette Sadiq Khan became the transportation commissioner, a longstanding position of ours was that the city should start building protected bikeways. And so that's the kind of thing where we can really raise the profile of a certain type of change that we want to see happen. And, it brings it to the attention of the decision makers who can ultimately enact the policy that will make it happen. It raises the profile of the issue with bigger media outlets. Like we've been reporting about how the police have investigated this cycling fatality that happened in Brooklyn recently, and all this news is coming to light about how sloppy they were and how the investigative file just does not seem to match the video evidence that's available. And we're seeing this story start to percolate up through bigger outlets like the New York Times website and the Village Voice. And, that's one of the ways that we exert an impact is by raising issues that we think are important and bringing them to the attention of bigger media outlets.
So when the Mayor Bloomberg appointed your new traffic commissioner, did he have in mind expanding bike paths and bike lanes and pedestrian safety? Was that part of the agenda and that is why he chose her? He knew the direction she would go?
Well, the what Jeanette Sadiq Khan has done as transportation commissioner fits into the broader context of New York Sustainability Plan, which which Bloomberg, I think, put out at the end of 2006 or beginning of 2007. So all the stuff you see happening in New York with the bike lanes and the bus lanes and the pedestrian plazas, those were initiatives that were kind of outlined in this Plan YC sustainability plan. And, you know, the person who StreetsBlog was trying to reach in those days was kind of was Bloomberg's number two, the deputy mayor named Dan Doktoroff.
Okay.
And, you know, he was kind of the deputy mayor who was in charge of agencies, including the DOT. And I think there's no question that he was reading StreetsBlog back in 2006 when this whole plan was coming together.
Interesting.
And, you know, part of what StreetsBlog was doing in those days was, you know, making life a little bit uncomfortable for the
sure.
the old transportation commissioner. And, you know, we're, you know, every day we're out there saying, you know, New York is falling behind London on pedestrian safety, and we're falling behind Copenhagen on bikeways. And it does not reflect well on the transportation commissioner at the time.
Well, you bring up an interesting point. When you're making these comparisons, you're making the comparisons to European cities. You're not actually saying, well, we're not falling behind. Well, we're falling behind Portland, or we're falling behind, you know, something else. So you are holding up the European cycling community, or pedestrian community, or transportation community, and saying New York should be on that level.
Yeah, well, at the time, there was nowhere in America you could point to and say, look at their protected bike lanes.
Yeah.
The ones in New York were the first ones in the country.
Sure.
And so, you know, the city had to overcome a whole lot of inertia to make that happen, because all the design guides that the American engineers have been putting out for decades, they don't include anything about a protected bike lane. So the sort of by necessity, the comparison was to Copenhagen for best practices in bicycling. Although you do see protected bike lanes in Montreal, for instance. So there are some North American examples.
Sure.
And we were pointing to a South American city, Bogota, as the city with bus rapid transit best practices. Now, what's interesting is that these days, there are lots of American cities where you can point and say they're really out in front and doing this, you know, in the best way. And I think, you know, New York is definitely now in a position where other American cities can sort of look at what's happened here and say, you know, they decided to design their streets in this different way. The sky didn't fall. It's actually making people safer. Why don't we give this a shot?
Well, so then you're saying you're seeing progress in the change of transportation since you joined the organization.
In terms of, you know, you mean like results on the street?
Yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, we're talking about turning around a really big ship.
True.
And so, you know, we have seen a doubling of the bike count in the center of New York. And there's every reason to believe that trend is going to continue. They're going to launch this bike share system in the summer, it looks like, and that's going to probably boost cycling levels a lot again. But, you know, it takes a long time to build, essentially from scratch, significant you know, bike mode share.
But you do see some momentum now that
wasn't
there
before.
Oh,
definitely. There's definitely like measurable
yeah.
change in the levels of cycling. There's very measurable change in the injury rates on city streets. When you put in these designs, you know, the traffic calms down, you know, the speeds aren't exceeding the speed limit, and people are safer and you're seeing less injuries.
What do you see as the most challenging issue, let's say, today and going forward for transportation? Obviously, funding is a big number, what else is out there that is challenging besides just funding?
I think it's the willingness to appropriate street space in a way that benefits, street safety, safe biking, safe walking, and efficient transit. I think when you get down to it, the bike lanes that really work are the ones where you can't have double parking. You can't have cars like violating the right of way of the cyclists. And to do that, you really have to make a choice, and often it can get pretty political, to divide up the road in a way that is going to take parking spaces or is going to take travel lanes.
Right.
And it goes the same for buses. If you want an efficient busway where the transit vehicle can move smoothly, it has to be a dedicated right of way for the bus. It can't get bogged down in traffic. And so really it doesn't take a lot of money to do that kind of thing. These are like very, very cost effective ways to make the transportation system safer and more efficient. The real hurdle is, finding the political will, to sort of reshape streets in a way that's unfamiliar to people. Can be kind of counterintuitive, the idea that taking away space from cars is actually going to help people move around in a better way. I think what's interesting about New York is that they're trying a lot of these new ideas, and they're going to be, great proof of concepts to other American cities that are, thinking about taking these new steps.
Well, I learned a lot from this. This is awesome. And I'm really excited. We report on New York a lot. When stories come up about New York, we look to New York to find out what's going on with bike paths and pedestrian and all kinds of things. I mean, my original contact for you was, can you help me talk to your commissioner? But you are as interesting as anybody I could have chosen. So I'm really excited to have been able to talk to you. So it's streetsblog.org. Can people just glom onto you? I mean, what if somebody wanted to have a streets blog in Cleveland? They're going to have their own blog, and everything goes through you, right?
Right. What they would have to do, we have full-time employees, right? Like we're not people blogging in our basement. We're reporters who are out there. We're like earning a living doing this. And there's, there's philanthropic support for this kind of thing. We have some advertising revenues coming in, cause we do have a pretty substantial audience. So really the prerequisite is if there are, a base of foundations and donors and, businesses who want to invest in this and think it will pay dividends for the city, we'd be glad to come in and work on setting up a streets blog and giving a reporter the resources to get that going. And I will say that so much is happening in cities, in American cities, that are not New York. I mean, in Cleveland, you have the Healthline is a big deal to transit people. That was really one of the first genuine bus rapid transit projects in an American city. And I know it hasn't been, perfect implementation-wise, but the numbers I've seen show, like, more people riding the bus and, a lot of new development being attracted by that investment in the transit system.
It's very cool. I was just on Euclid Avenue this past week, and that was the first time I went from University Circle, which is where it starts pretty much, where they've put that new dedicated, center of the road, sort of. That's where the bus shelters are, and the bus goes down and the bike lanes are on the outside. It's very, very cool. I liked it a lot. It also slowed things down, which I thought was very interesting. It wasn't at all congested. Everything kept moving, but it was at a slower pace so that you didn't feel like you were in this crazy rush hour kind of insanity that you did on the other arterial roads. It is a very pretty change and very different. Very,
yeah.
Very different.
I mean, one of the fascinating things about how traffic works is that you can actually move more people if the even when your maximum speed goes down. I mean, the one of the ways that the bus rapid transit improves speeds isn't from the buses like achieving a really rapid speed. It's from minimizing the amount of time that they spend stopped.
Right. Sure. Makes sense to me that
you're
traveling more consistently at a lower speed than you stop and go at high speeds. Well, Ben, this has been awesome. I really appreciate you taking time to talk to us this evening. And again, it's streetsblog.org. And we'll keep reading.
All right. Thanks, Diane.
Thank you.
Take care.
Good night.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Ben Fried, the editor-in-chief of streetsblog.org, joined us from New York City.
From his office. Yeah. I didn't hear any honking and screaming.
No, seems like they've got it under control there.
Yeah.
I like his take on speeds.
Yeah, you know, me too.
That's the Calvin's challenge model.
Slow and steady wins the race.
That's right. It's not how fast you ride. It's how consistent and how much you can stay on the bike. So
exactly.
It works the same in the streets.
Yep. Well, and I could see it. I'm telling you, I drove down Euclid, which I had to go to this new yoga class that I'll be teaching beginning next week. And I hadn't been down. I mean, I've been in University Circle a lot, but wow, it is cool. Of course, the Cleveland Clinic has a lot of that property on either side of Euclid Avenue.
There's a lot to see on Euclid Avenue.
There
and
is.
You can actually now, you know,
you
take note
it.
Of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Very cool.
So that was fun.
Yes. Now we have a little business to take care of.
Yes, we do.
Because coming up in the middle of February is WJCU's annual Radiothon.
And if you like the Outspoken Cyclist, we are volunteers. Greg and I come here and do our show.
Everyone at WJCU
everyone
is a volunteer.
Does. Yes. We do it out of love, L-U-V.
And 60% of WJCU's operating budget comes from you, our listeners, whether you listen over the air
or through a podcast,
on the web stream or in the podcast. 60% of what it takes to actually operate WJCU
comes from this one week.
1 week of the year when we ask our listeners. And we know that you get asked by a lot of charities, by other radio stations, by all kinds of people for your money. So we do empathize with that. But we also know that we have to pay the bills around here because, you know, equipment and electricity and things like that, just they don't come to us for free.
Gigabytes.
Yeah, bandwidth is an expense. You know, so our labor comes to us for free. The other things we have to pay for, and we do try and stretch a dollar pretty darn far around here.
If you like us and want to support us, we will have a way for you to do that beginning the week of, I think, the 17th.
Yeah, around the middle of February.
Right.
More specific details to come, but just sort of get that stuck in the back of your mind, if you would.
That we're going
to
beat on you again for a little bit of your hard-earned money.
That's right. And then we leave you alone for the next 51 weeks.
Exactly.
All right.
All right.
Well, we're going to step outside once again and see what season we're in Northeast
Could be
Ohio.
Anything.
Could be anything.
Right.
But it's been nice so far, and we hope that weather in your area is well enough to get out for an occasional ride at least.
Or it's trainer season.
Yeah. That's right. If not, it's time to ride the bike to nowhere.
Right.
All right. We'll see you somewhere in another week for the Outspoken Cyclist.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.